This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and this is Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, the slaughter of more than 190 dolphins has sparked debate about culture and conservation in Solomon Islands. Papua New Guinea's cabinet has given the green light for treaty talks that could see its citizens serving in Australia's Defence Force. And the Easter weekend is one of the most important religious events in the Pacific. We'll find out how people in the region are marking it. Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. A social media video showing more than 190 dolphins killed during a cultural ritual has sparked outrage in Solomon Islands. The dolphins were killed in Malaita province as part of a centuries-old tradition. While many are defending the practice, one environmentalist is calling for stronger laws restricting the number of dolphins that can be killed in such events. The ABC's Caroline Tierman with more.
On the video, which has been shared thousands of times on Facebook, rows and rows of dead dolphins can be seen in a village. Some of them are still breathing. The video, shot on Malaita, Silifo Island, captures the end of a dolphin calling and cultural ritual. Since being posted online, the video has sparked criticism, with Solomon Islands Facebook users calling the practice barbaric. But chairman of the church in Silifo Island, Jack Bakale, says the ritual has long been practiced by generations of people on the island.
A part of culture where
it's part of our culture where we get them from the wild, and it is part of our wealth, especially our people from Lau, who use it for bride price. And if people put their price beside the red money, then people need thousands of dolphin teeth to add to the bride price. That's why we conducted that event. But everyone in the communities in Sulufo discuss everything to do with the dolphin calling.
Chairman Bakale says they go out hunting when weather permits. Lawrence Makili Kepangi is a Solomon Islands conservationist. He once led a campaign to put a stop to the export of live dolphins. Mr. Kepangi says it's high time the government introduces legislation to control the numbers of dolphins killed in the name of culture.
This happens because there's no proper regulation within the Fisheries Act or the Environmental Act in looking at the management of the species or the protection of the species. There's lacking regulations and laws in that particular part of the laws of the country. That is why people continue to hunt dolphins, you know, in the name of cultural or custom practice.
What would you like to see done by the government or even the people whose custom it is to hunt dolphins?
I would, as much as possible, to see the government develop, you know, a kind of regulation that controls, especially regulating these customary practices. Since it is a very complex issue, there should be studies done in order for us to, you know, to come up with the management for these practices.
Under Solomon Islands laws, the export of dolphins and dolphin products is illegal. But the hunting of dolphins using dugout canoes for traditional purposes is allowed. But there are no specific restrictions on the number of dolphins caught. In Sulufo and parts of Malaita, dolphin teeth are highly valued. Online, the debate between supporters and critics of the cultural practice continues to rage on. What's clear is that, thanks to technology, it doesn't take long for photos of activities taking place in communities to be shared online. And it's this speed of information that Lawrence Makili says could be damaging for the country's tourism industry.
You have different sectors of tourism that travels around the world. Some are nature-based tourists, some adventurous tourists. Solomon Island tourism at the moment is based on this niche market, not on mass. So these are the very people that are so much concerned about environmental issues.
Solomon Islands environmentalist Lawrence Makili Kapangi ending that report from Caroline Tierman with production support from the ABC's Solomon Islands reporter Kristen Rita Amanu-Leong. And Pacific Beat has sought comment from the Solomon Islands government. In a sign of warming relations between Papua New Guinea and Australia, the PNG government has given the go-ahead for treaty talks that could lead to Papua New Guinean soldiers serving in the Australian Defence Force. With PNG's Foreign Minister Justin Kachenko lobbying in the background for Australia's Labour government to be re-elected and calling their work in the Pacific tremendous, Defence Minister Billy Joseph says the start of fresh treaty talks will be a big move and one that could bring the two countries even closer together.
Negotiation has not yet started. Just last week, the National Executive Council has unanimously agreed for the mandate. So the mandate has been given, and therefore it now paves way for the Department of Foreign Affairs and the responsible ministry, which is Department of Defense and the Papua New Guinea Defense Force, to now initiate with their counterpart in Australia to start having a zero draft and then having a conversation on what kind of outcomes that both countries would want to get out of the treaty. So as you would understand, I would not be giving you any details as to what the technical terms would be, but that would be definitely once final draft is achieved, it will be then also passed through our own system, that is through to the National Security Council, the CSCC process, then to NEC, and if NEC approves, it goes to Parliament. So at this stage, to answer your question, no negotiation has actually commenced.
The foreign minister mentioned that part of this treaty, or the purpose of this treaty, would be to allow Papua New Guineans to serve in the Australian Defence Force. How exactly do you see that playing out, or how would that work exactly under this treaty?
We also aware that there is an issue within Australia to recruit the PNGDF, and they also have a policy to go out and recruit from the Pacific. And so our position from the PNG perspective is that PNG is the only country that was colonized by Australia, and PNG has very strong cultural and historical relationship with Australia. And so we also are the biggest country in the Pacific. And we do believe that much of that numbers has to come from PNG. Papua New Guinea Defence Force back in 1942, at that time it was called the Papuan Infantry Battalion and the New Guinea Infantry Battalion. You know, they fought with the Australian Defence Force in the ditches. So PNGDF and ADF working together, PNG citizens serving in the ADF, is not a new thing. We've done this before. It's just that the conversation is different because we are now an independent country for over 50 years. But, with the geopolitics and the security environment in the region, it is really important that we build and strengthen our defense ties with people that share the same values and history and future. And this is why this conversation about the treaty is happening at this time. It is not because we feel that we are threatened by others.
But what happens if it does come to a conflict scenario? Will this treaty sort of include some provisions or some guarantees that Australia and PNG are allied in a conflict scenario?
If there's any conflict in Australia, whether we like it or not, PNG is still going to get involved. And that is why it is important that we have interoperability and integration of our two defence forces.
Papua New Guinea's Defence Minister Billy Joseph speaking to the ABC's Papua New Guinea correspondent Marion Farr. In Australia, Pacific youth continue to be overrepresented in the justice system when it comes to youth crime. But in New South Wales, a group of dedicated caseworkers, police officers, and former youth offenders think they've found an answer to buck the trend through their Pacific culture. Created behind the walls of Cobham Youth Justice Center, the Pacifica program has given youth offenders a sense of community, identity, and the tools to create positive change in their lives. Alice Lola here went inside the prison system to take a look at how it all works.
Once a week, at Cobham Juvenile Justice Centre in Sydney's Outer West, a group of boys get together for a day of cultural connection to their island heritage. The brick walls echo with the sound of Fijian hymns and Samoan chants. There's Pacific delicacies and a bowl of gava to share.
Pacific Island boys, you know, we tend to steer away from what we've known our whole life. And then we come here, especially in an uncomfortable environment. And then the centre gives us this opportunity to learn about culture again. We're talking to people that have been in our shoes before. You know, we're not talking to scientists with a clipboard, you know what I mean? So easier to just relate.
It's part of the centre's Pacifica programme, co-founded by Leilani Tsonomaipea, who's an assistant manager at the centre.
In 2019, the gang issues were quite active in the community, and the Conlights building, as young people were placed in custody, because there was a predominant cohort of Pacific Islander young people that were placed in custody, involved in gangs. We looked at what was the best way to help them safely go through youth justice or in custodial settings without harming other young people.
Caseworker Siata Tala says there were tough times in the early days.
Initially we had two separate rival gang groups who were unable to mix, and it took about 6 to 9 months for intense workshops, one-on-one work with them, for us to even consider bringing those two groups together, which was massive.
There have been more success stories since.
One of our long-term boys, like, to see where he started from, and this was a young person who was considered high risk, who they were close to transferring to jail. He completely changed the situation, and that was on him taking accountability for, you know, his actions and making the choice to change. And this young person went on to, you know, complete TAFE courses, complete his HSC. He's one of the first in his family to complete his HSC. And that was all through the support, through Pacifica, through the support of staff at Cobham.
Professor Joji Ravulo is Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney. He says Pacific youth account for around 30% of youth justice cases, despite making up less than 2% of the population in the area. Professor Ravulo believes initiatives like Cobham's Pacifica program is a novel way to address the issue.
It's trying to understand what has led to this person doing the crime, and how do we then potentially create support to counteract that criminal behaviour in the first place. If we are able to ensure that diverse ways of looking at the world, like how Pacific people look at their health more holistically, if we can meaningfully incorporate that into our welfare system, then that gets better outcomes.
The Pacifica program has recently received funding from the Department of Communities and Justice to begin training staff statewide, with Queensland and Victoria Youth Justice also reaching out. Caseworker Siata wants to see it continue and grow long into the future.
Because I really believe that, you know, through this program we do plant seeds and we can start changing mindsets. But all the other stuff comes with it, the support, you know, both in custody and the community to help these young people, you know, take that step to change.
And that was caseworker Siata Tala ending that report from Alice Lolahea. The best weightlifters in the Pacific were in Melbourne to compete in the Oceania International event. Samoa's powerful team scooped up a hat full of medals, but not for the first time. Much of the attention was on Eileen Dikamatana, who's been competing for Australia since 2019 after she fell out with her weightlifting federation in Fiji. at the Olympic Games in Paris last year. She just missed out on a medal, and now her focus is on a third consecutive Commonwealth gold in Scotland next year. The ABC's Finau Fonua went to watch all the action.
Let's go.
It's a really hot day today in Hawthorne, an iconic suburb of Melbourne, home to the Hawthorne Hawks. And I'm here at the Victorian Weightlifting Stadium and had the opportunity to watch the best weightlifters from across the Pacific and Australia compete against each other. It's an invitational cup. It's a warm-up tournament, as some would call it. And no doubt, the standout athlete of the tournament was Aileen Thikamatana. She represents Australia, but hails from Fiji and has a remarkable story. She broke all of the Commonwealth records.
Breaking records is something that comes after what we're trying to achieve. Breaking record is a bonus, but we just love enjoying ourselves in lifting and trying to be better than our previous competitions. Doesn't matter how good or how bad. We're just here to enjoy. We're just here to lift. And in competitions, I compete within myself because I am my worst enemy and I can be my worst competitor as well, because I can be good today and bad tomorrow. So when I come to competition, I just prepare myself and compete within myself and be better of who I was in the last competition I competed in, yeah.
I spoke to Paul Coffer, a legend in Australian weightlifting. He basically adopted Aileen Thikamatana when she was just 15 and devoted all of his experience, all of his skill sets, all of his knowledge into developing her.
I coached her for 8 years now, 2 Commonwealth Games gold medals, 11 medals at the World Championships. She's the ultimate. She's in line to win the 3rd gold medal next year in Glasgow for the Commonwealth Games. She won 2. In 2018, the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games, 2022, Birmingham, and now she's going for 3rd gold. Not too many athletes can do that, and she's going to win easy. She's breaking Commonwealth records. Nobody will touch her, but the Olympics is the one. She wants to win a gold medal in Los Angeles in 2028, that's what she wants.
Do you think she's on track to possibly being Australia's greatest weightlifter?
No question. She is the Australian greatest, but that gold medal is the one that counts.
Gold medalist and Commonwealth Games champion, representing Australia, Aileen Thikamatana.
Tears in her eyes. An incredible talent. Coached by Paul Coffer.
Another standout athlete at this competition is a newcomer, the 16-year-old Nehemiah Elder from Fiji. This guy is a record breaker in the Commonwealth Youth Senior 89-kilogram category. And today, he also broke all of the Commonwealth Youth records.
When I was young, my parents were, my dad was the head coach and my stepmother was the president. So yeah, I was brought up within the sport and I decided to take it seriously when I turned 9. Yeah, that was a, yeah, I've been in the sport ever since I was young. Coming into this comp, I had to cut a few kilos, so yeah, I had to change my diet. And like training, in terms of training, yeah, it's very hard. Twice a day, sometimes even 3, from Monday to Saturday. Sunday is the only day we get off, so yeah, I'd say it's pretty intense.
The Pacific athletes dominated this competition. Team Samoa did well. Don Opalonge, the Samoan Commonwealth champion, won his event as expected. You also had Solomon Islander weightlifter Jenly Tegu Winnie. She was the 2023 Sportswoman of the Year, won bronze medalist at the Commonwealth Games. a real role model for women in the Solomon Islands and across the Pacific.
I'm a proud Solomon Islander, and I represent weightlifting in many events and Oceania and Commonwealth. Me happy too much for representing Solomon Island, and this fella event, one fella big event where me for every elite athlete come together and compete. And after this competition, another 4 days for training camp. So, me happy too much.
What an awesome competition. The winner today is no doubt Pacific weightlifting in general. And I can tell you, we're probably going to see more than just one gold medalist from the Pacific at the Commonwealth Games and possibly at the Olympic Games in 2028.
And that was the ABC's Final for Nua with that report. Across the Pacific, Easter is a time for church services and family gatherings, with a long weekend an opportunity for sporting events. But what does it mean for many Pacific Islanders who are away from their home working in Australia's labour mobility scheme? Well, the ABC's Caroline Turman caught up with some of them, but first she checked in on what the long weekend means for those back home in Papua New Guinea.
Reverend Jack Urame is head of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Papua New Guinea, and he says Easter will be a very special time for his people.
They will celebrate church services, but, you know, at the church level, we also, you know, meet and then celebrate this occasion, in a very special way, because this is an opportunity for us to call families together, families, you know, who are scattered and divided because of, you know, many injustices and so on. So they come together and then they sing and they pray and they celebrate together. So this is the message. And then some communities will reflect on this by doing this, what they call Easter March, reflecting the crucifixion of Jesus and carrying the cross and so on, to, you know, reflect what it means to be Christian and also to celebrate that special occasion.
Many Pacific Islanders will be celebrating this Easter away from home because they are engaged in the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme in both Australia and New Zealand. However, they still continue to follow their faith, like Alberta Sokoliana from Bougainville, who lives with her family in Melbourne.
So we will be going for the Station of the Cross as our community here in St. Luke's, and really just spending the day after that.
Tell me about the Bougainville farm workers who will be joining you for Easter.
So while they're coming here, is mainly we will all go to church for church service, and then after that we're planning to do aigir, a traditional way of cooking. And they can have a feel of home-cooked food at home, as they are always busy and they don't have enough time to do that at work.
What sort of food are you going to be putting in your mumu?
Okay, so we have taro. We've already got taro. We've got banana, kaukau, which is sweet potato. And we also have yam for them and cassava. So with pork, lamb, and some seafood as in fish and crab.
In New South Wales, Reverend Viliami Ita Kolamatangi says he is going to be leading an Easter camp for Pacific Island youth in New South Wales this weekend.
The usual work of the Baham, they will be participating with the church in the church program. As you maybe understand, I also related to the church, as I am a church minister looking after the youth of Australia, in Perth and in Victoria and in Queensland and New South Wales. And also the youth camp will be in Queensland and in Victoria and in Perth also at the same time.
During this youth camp, what are you all going to be doing?
Basically, they focus on spiritual leadership trainings and Bible spiritual exercise, Bible studies, and because of the school holidays, we do have some sports and some games with the young ones.
Why is it important to have the young people get together at a time like Easter?
There are a few other things. Just to fulfill their time, getting busy, getting rid of being around in the community, and also stop them from using of alcohol and drugs. That's the major part of having a special program during the Easter because of the school holiday.
No big cook-ups like Pacific Islanders do?
They all do the same thing. They are eating roast beef.
And that was Reverend Viliame Ita Kolomatangi, and the reporter there was Caroline Tierman. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from the Pacific.